All right, and now we get to the part we've all been waiting for. Maud Barlow is the National Chairperson of the Council of Canadians and chairs the board of Washington-based Food and Water Watch. She is also an executive member of the San Francisco-based International Forum on Globalization and a counselor with the Hamburg-based World Future Council. Maud is the recipient of 10 honorary doctorates as well as many awards, including the 2005 Right Livelihood Award, known as the Alternative Nobel, the Citation of Lifetime Achievement at the 2008 Canadian Environment Award, and the 2009 Earth Day Canada Outstanding Environmental Achievement Award. In 2008-2009, she served as senior advisor on water to the 63rd President of the United Nations General Assembly. She is also the best-selling author or co-author of 16 books, including the international bestseller Blue Covenant, The Global Water Crisis, and The Coming Battle for the Right to Water. Maud is also going to be receiving an honorary degree from the University of Lethbridge at the Friday morning convocation this year. And after Maud speaks, she would be willing to take questions from the audience. So as you're listening, you can be thinking about your questions. So please join me in welcoming Maud Barlow.
Wow. Thank you very, very, very much for such a warm welcome, Sheila and Knut and all of the members of the council chapter here and all of you. I know there's a big hockey game on tonight, and I'm really impressed you're here. And also, we haven't had that many lovely nights yet of this first of summer, so thank you for being here. Thank you, Lois, for those absolutely gorgeous words. Very deeply moving, and also for my wonderful T-shirt. Thank you, Chief Mike Brucehead, Chief Bird, in your own words, and thank you for the blessing. It was absolutely beautiful and deeply appreciated. And Denise, for your music. I don't know where you are. It's hard to see you from up here, but you were beautiful and totally appropriate. So I am, yes, going to talk to about some threats to Alberta's water. And although we said there were three, I'm actually going to bore you with four. And I'm just going to add one. But we'll start with the one that we've started with here tonight, and that is the whole notion of fracking, this next level of accessing through a very dangerous mining technique more natural gas, the way we release gas from the ground. There are currently over 11,000 coal seam vertical wells in Alberta. So, I mean, the damage has already been started, and Mike made the point to me chatting out there earlier that some of the contamination has started at least a decade ago. But fracturing is a whole new method of taking large amounts of water and lacing them with chemicals and then shooting them with very high pressure into the ground vertically and then horizontally. And they pressure it so hard and with such intense chemicals that it's kind of like a bullet hitting a windshield, and it cracks the rock seam and the natural gas escapes. There are literally thousands and thousands and thousands of operations and gas wells under construction for fracking around North America and actually around the world now. It has become just a free-for-all. It reminds me of the gold rush or something, where everybody's trying to get in on this. What we know is that it's very, very bad for water in three ways. One is that it releases methane gas that gets into drinking water. The second is that it uses a huge amount of water. As much as 40 million liters of water are needed per well. And when you think of the thousands and thousands that we're talking about, it's just an incredible amount of water that's taken in. But as you heard from Mike, there's a poison cocktail of chemicals that are then used to pump this water through. The New York State Environment Department decided to do an analysis of what kind of and how many chemicals were used in fracking just in New York State, and they found 257 chemicals. And they have a list of them that takes 10 pages to list, and they're everything awful that you can think of, from benzene and naphthalene to diesel fuel to heavy metals and so on. It's a very, very, very dangerous practice and one that is becoming very controversial. The reason that the United States and more recently Canada, and of course we're always often supplying the U.S. with our energy, we call ourselves America's gas tank. One of the reasons is that the United States is trying to get energy independent. They're trying to lose their dependence, particularly on Middle East energy. And so the notion of fracking, the notion of being able to release this natural gas under the ground and have it within your own borders, or certainly at least within North America, is very tantalizing. And so you have the Obama administration actually promoting gas fracking in big time with subsidies happening here in this country as well, and of course with the Alberta government not only giving subsidies but removing essential environmental regulatory hurdles, because they're actually concerned that there's more fracking going on in British Columbia and Saskatchewan. So there's now a competition to bring these energy companies back in. So I just want to say that it is very, very clear that what's happening here in with the Kenai and the communities here is happening around North America and around the world, and that is where this energy exploration is taking place, is happening in Indigenous territories. It's the theft of Indigenous rights and the theft of Indigenous waters, and we have to work really, really hard with First Nations communities to expose this theft, to expose what I consider to be a crime taking place in First Nations communities against the human rights and the environmental rights of human of First Nations people, and that we will stand with the Kainai people and other First Nations communities in this country and around the world when they fight for their fundamental rights. And I think it's really important for us to remember that the United Nations adopted 4 years ago now the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And you're not supposed to be able to do any of this without full and prior consent of the whole community. So we're breaking a lot of rules, including international agreements, when this kind of treatment happens. That's the first question, the first concern that I wanted to warn us about, and also to very much support the Blood people on in their demand, or the community within the nation in their demand that there be a moratorium placed on this fracking until there's full investigation, full consultation, and people feel that it's safe to go ahead, which I guarantee you will not find when you do the work that has to be done. And you should know that there are communities around the United States and, in fact, around the world that have come up with local ordinances or even national laws. France has absolutely banned fracking within its borders. Now, that doesn't mean it doesn't have energy companies looking for this natural gas other places. Sometimes countries pass laws that protect their own people but allow their corporations to do horrible things in other countries. Perfect example are our mining companies in Canada, which do some pretty bad things here, but they do some really bad things in other countries. And, you know, we look the other way, or certainly our governments look the other way, as they destroy the water tables and the lands and the livelihood of, again, very often Indigenous peoples. But I think we need to talk about a moratorium on fracking in this country, and our organization is absolutely pledging to work with you to have this happen in this community, but also nationally. The second concern that I'd like to raise, and all of these have in common, by the way, the commodification of water. Water being seen as a tool to either unlock other riches like natural gas, or water actually in and of itself being a commodity. And this really is at the deepest heart's core of what we're fighting, is this notion of water as a commodity. But the second concern I have is something called virtual water exports. And you may not know much about this, but you're going to hear more about this with time. Virtual water is the water that is used to produce things that we then either use or export away. And that is very often, of course, food products. Grains are very heavy, virtual water users, livestock, and so on. Computers take a lot of water to create. Everything we do, in fact, has a very heavy water footprint. And we've just published a study, and you can get it on our website, canadians.org. It's called Leaky Exports. And it's a study of the export of virtual water in this country. And we're not yet putting pipelines into water sources and shipping them out of the country, but we might as well be, because we are shipping massive amounts of water, and it's called the water footprint, in our products and commodities and so on away. Now, what do we mean by this? Well, the footprint of a country is the amount of water it takes for its goods and services. And then the question becomes, are you using your own water to produce this footprint, or are you importing this footprint? And you won't be surprised to know that richer countries are often able to buy their way out of a water crisis by importing all the things that it takes water to make. Great Britain, for instance, imports two-thirds of its water use. People think water use is your showers and, you know, the dishwasher and all of that kind of thing. That's a piece of it, but by far the biggest amount of water that you and I use every day is in the products that we eat and consume and use, and the water that was used to make them. And that's very seldom factored in when we're thinking about water. So this is a kind of a new concept, and a lot of very exciting work's being done on it. Then you get countries like Japan and Saudi Arabia, very wealthy, literally importing most of their water footprint. I was in a beautiful lake called Lake Naivasha in Kenya in East Africa a couple of years ago. It's in the Rift Valley, and it's one of the most exquisite places I've ever been. And it's a place that was a traditional watering ground for the Maasai people. They were hunter-gatherers. And it's just an exquisite lake. And I was taken out on a boat, an old wooden boat, with a tall Maasai elder who stood and paddled with a big orb standing. And we saw a hippopotamus herd in the water. And he said, "We don't get too close to those. They're very dangerous." And it was a very moving moment. And I looked at a beautiful island that had wildebeests and giraffes. And I said, "You know, that just reminds me of the movie Out of Africa." And he said, "That would be because that's where Out of Africa was filmed, right there," you know. And I could look and see Meryl Streep waiting for Robert Redford, you know, landing his plane. But what's the tragedy about this beautiful traditional Maasai lake in this beautiful Rift Valley in Kenya is that it's been taken over by foreign rose companies, roses as in flowers. It takes a lot of water to grow roses. And so if you live in Europe, and you give your sweetheart a Valentine rose on Valentine's Day, 99% chance it's come from Lake Naivasha. And so the local Maasai people have no access to the water anymore. It has been taken up by these industries, and they are sucking the water so fast, it's already down 25%. The hippopotamus are dying. And the companies are already choosing the next lake that they're going to go to. Now, we know that we're able to destroy big bodies of water. I mean, Lake Chad, another lake in Africa, has been over-extracted. It was the sixth biggest lake in the world. It's been over-extracted and is now down 90%. It's down to 10% of its original size. And it supplied the water to many, many millions of Africans in its region. So we are actually able to take whole bodies of water and destroy them with this practice of global trade, where we just move the water from one place to another. And I have a quote that I think is an important one. This analyst said, you know, this notion that the wars of the future will be fought over water. Well, you know, that's not going to be armies of, you know, that is going to be grain traders on the floor of global stock exchanges. That's where the water wars are happening. That's where the water is going. And we need to understand that. Canada is a net exporter of virtual water. That means we send out way more virtual water than we bring in. And that it amounts to about 30, a volume enough to fill the Rogers Centre, the big stadium in Toronto, 37 and a half times every single year. That's the amount of water that's leaving our area, leaving our watersheds in the form of these exports. Now, Alberta is very much at risk because Alberta, with just 2% of the country's water supply, accounts for two-thirds of the country's water used for irrigation, again, mostly for export to the United States. And even, you know, when every year, for instance, just the amount of water that we export in grain production, just the water that's used to produce grain that's then exported away, equals twice the annual discharge of the Athabasca River. So if you ask yourself where the water is going in this province, and yes, I know there have been some floods and there's been some relief, but it's a short-term relief, I can assure you. We have a water crisis in Alberta, and a lot of the reason we have a crisis here is that we are exporting our water away, and it's usually in the hands of a couple of big grain traders and the hands, livestock companies and so on. Very important for us to understand who's controlling the use and abuse of this water. And we have a huge proposed coming increase in livestock production in this province with all the attendant destruction of the water systems that are going to come with it. So that's my second concern. The destruction of water through fracking, the destruction of an export of massive amounts of water through this virtual water. The third is that Alberta is the first province in the country to move to something called water markets, water trading, and you're going to hear a lot more about that as well. Water trading is where you convert a license to access water to actual water rights, and then you say to the companies or whoever, but it's usually companies, we think that you're going to use this water more efficiently because if you can sell your excess for profit, then you're going to be more efficient at what you use. In other words, you'll use less. And it's a very, very dangerous trend because, of course, this is not what happens. In a world running out of fresh water, and let me tell you, there is a new study from the World Bank and a number of the big water-intensive industries. It said that by 2030, which isn't very long time away, the demand in our world for water will outstrip supply by 40%. That is an incredible statistic if you can begin to start to imagine the suffering behind a statement like that, not only to the human species, but to other species as well. Every 3.5 seconds now in the global south, a child dies of waterborne disease. It is the single biggest killer of children, more than HIV, AIDS, malaria, war, and accidents put together. It is the number one killer. So in a world running out of available fresh water, and yes, it's still on the planet somewhere, but we've polluted it, mismanaged it, or displaced it from where we can get at it to where we cannot. We have basically two options, really two fundamentally different paths to take. One is to say that the water is a public trust and that it belongs to everyone in that community and it has to be equitably shared, and therefore you have to have a plan and therefore you have to fiercely protect it. And that's one route that's being taken by some governments. The other is put it on the market, let it be a commodity like energy or shoes or Coca-Cola, whatever, let it be out there and let it rise to its natural price. And it will become very expensive, but people will take care of it because it costs a lot of money. And of course, in that scenario, people aren't stopping to think of the millions more who will die, because when you put that dollar price on it, and I'm not against a decent service charge for the delivery of water. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about privatizing water, actually allowing the privatization of water. When you do that, then you start buying and selling water on the open market. And there are parts of the world that are moving to this very quickly. Most of the U.S. West, most of the Western states in the U.S. have moved to markets. There's a guy named T. Boone Pickens who has made himself rich, hoarding energy, and now he's hoarding the Ogallala Aquifer, which is that big aquifer down the spine of the United States that has grown all their food on the plains for so many years, and by the way, will be gone within the foreseeable future, and there will not be growing food on the plains of the United States, and this comes from the U.S. Geological Survey. They are saying there's just no question it will run out. The only question is how fast that's going to happen. So you get this guy taking a resource that everybody needs and people are desperate for, and he's actually using his money to buy up shares and holding it until it's worth more money. Chile has probably gone farther than any other country in the world. Chile not only privatized its services so that 100% of water services are private and you have to pay very, very high rates to get water delivered to your house and wastewater treatment as well, but they actually sell the actual water, the physical water, which is quite unusual. India started to do that with some rivers, but it's unusual still. Chile allows public auctions where big companies, often mining companies from Canada and others, come in and they outbid, because they've got more money, local municipalities, local First Nations communities, local small farmers and so on who can't afford it, and they literally then take that water, physically remove that water, or have it to use to, for their mining practices. Chile is an extreme example. And again, anybody interested in reading about this, on our website we have a new study on the water trading in Chile. The one I know best is Australia, because I've traveled a lot there and I love Australia. The Australians have one basic water source. It's the Murray-Darling River that it goes from the north and goes down into the ocean in the south. It used to. It's now not reaching the mouth of the ocean anymore. They're the driest inhabited planet on Earth. And what they've done is allow massive agribusiness to grow up around it, siphoning that water off and exporting it through virtual water exports. Cotton, which is very water-intensive. Rice, which is water-intensive. Their wonderful wine that everyone loves. That's their water just being exported around the world. And they're in quite a desperate situation. So in 1993, the then government decided to convert water licenses, where these big agribusiness companies actually had licenses. They gave them licenses to access this water, said, these are now water rights, and you now own this water. And basically, you can trade these rights back and forth. And so they started trading, and of course what happened was the big guys started buying out the little guys, and the big corporate farm conglomerates started hoarding the water rights. And then, as I predicted when I was first there and everybody said, oh, it won't happen, they started letting investors come in. First of all, Australian investors, and then international investors. And they actually have international investors buying up the water rights of Australians and then leasing that land and water back to tenant farmers and now telling them that what they want them to grow. So here is not a so-called third world country. Here is a so-called first world country whose farmers are now taking orders in many ways, in many places, from international investors. These big hedge funds that are just moving around the world buying up stuff. They have bought up an area of land in Africa alone twice the size of the United Kingdom just to hold on to that land and that water for a future time when they're going to want it and need it, and it'll be worth even more money. And, of course, then they started running out of water in the Murray-Darling, and more progressive government came in, and they tried to buy back the water rights because they needed the water for the environment to put it back into the system, the watershed. But they couldn't afford it. The price of water went up from $2 a gigaliter to $2,400 in one decade. It became a $30 million business just overnight. And there are now dozens and dozens of fly-by-night brokers who have absolutely no regulatory system, are just buying and selling water, and water has just become an absolute free-for-all. I mean, talk about like a gold rush, like putting a stake in the ground. This is where Alberta is going to go if we allow water rights to take place and take hold here. The government is saying, but the people of Alberta will still own the water. All we're doing is giving the companies the right to sell and trade shares. That's what they said in Australia, and now constitutional experts are saying technically, in the Constitution, the water of Australia belongs to the people of Australia. But we don't know how you would ever enforce that when a transnational corporation from another country or a transnational hedge fund owns that water. How would you assert that it really belongs to the Australian people? What does that mean? When you have superimposed on what was supposed to be kind of a public trust doctrine or that it belonged to the people, when you superimpose a system that says, no, it's a, you know, we're going to give this power to these corporations. Number four threat, and I really we're going to get to some happy things in a minute. My husband says, do people really willingly come and hear you? Are they crazy? Number four threat that I'm worried about is something you probably don't know much about, and it's called CETA. CETA is the Canada-European Union Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, and it's the latest and biggest trade agreement to come down the pike, and the one that I am most worried about of all of the trade agreements. This is an agreement between Canada and Europe that is very nearly finished. They've been negotiating quietly under the radar screen. Prime Minister Harper doesn't want us talking about it, unlike Mulroney, who used to say, you know, give me 20 years and I'll change this country, and used to boast about it. These guys just want to say, look, this is nothing to do with you. Don't you worry about it. We've got this under control, and it's just flying under the radar screen. But it's a really dangerous agreement. First of all, you need to know that it is, for the first time, going to allow corporations, in this case European corporations, access to different levels of government. The NAFTA and the WTO only allow access to procurement, that is competition for government spending at the federal level. This one's going to allow it for provincial, municipal, schools, hospitals, water systems, you know, you name it, they're all going to be open to competition from big European companies. And under NAFTA, you cannot give new access to a new, under a new agreement, to different countries without giving it to the corporations of the NAFTA country too. So it really, this means that the whatever the big service companies from Europe gain in terms of access, the companies from the United States are going to gain. And they're not only going to be able to come in, what they want to do is they want to sell services that we now consider to be public, you know, part of our social security and public services. They want to come in and compete with the public services and be able to provide services. And what you should know is that Europe, which we all sort of thought was kind of cool, has been privatizing transit, energy, water services, you name it. They have been privatizing like crazy. And as they've been privatizing and bringing in what's called public-private partnerships, all these big service industry companies have grown up, and they're big, and they're mostly bigger than the service industries in the United States. And they're actually ones that worry me a lot more than American companies. Food service companies. There's one called Compass that delivers 4 billion meals a year to schools and hospitals around the world, moving big time into Canada. We're just fighting a fight at Kingston General, where they've outsourced their food production and preparation. It means all those jobs will be lost. They're not going to source local farmers anymore, and they're not going to give their patients nutritious food. It's going to be shipped in from a Compass warehouse in Mississauga, so take hours to go down the highway. And I've seen the packaging. It's in that heavy, heavy plastic, vacuum plastic stuff, and it says it has the date of when they packaged it, and then the date when before which you have to eat it, and it's like 3 weeks. You know, within 3 weeks you eat it, and it's not refrigerated. I mean, you want to know what's in this stuff. We have one of the QP workers there who was very concerned about this and fighting it, left it in his garage for months. It still hasn't broken down. The food is still looking quite intact, thank you very much, in this package. These companies want an agreement that seals in their right to have, in perpetuity, to have access to these contracts. They also want our natural resources. And they're in a huge fight with China to lock in access in perpetuity to diamonds, forests, fish, energy, you know, whatever it is that we, potash, whatever it is that we have here that they need to stay as a superpower, they are seeking permanent rights. Now, I'm worried about it in every conceivable way, but I am really worried about it for water, because the two biggest utilities, private utilities in the world, are Suez and Veolia, and they're from France, and they're 100% behind this agreement, and they've been promoting it from the beginning. And it's going to give them the right to compete with local firms. You won't be able to give any preferential treatment to local firms or local communities, local economic development, local First Nations hiring. All of that will have to go. And these companies will be able to come in and bid for the billions of dollars that needs to be put into water infrastructure in our country. And that is the step, the 1-2 step to privatization. And they will claim ownership of the actual water. And we have a bad precedent that most people, again, our media is not always telling us what we need to hear. We have long argued, those of us who fought NAFTA, that NAFTA gave American corporations in Canada rights to our water and to other natural resources that they needed for their production. And sure enough, we were proven right. The government said, oh, don't be silly. Well, you say all such silly things. And then, of course, it's been proven with a case. The company's called Abitibi Bow Water. It's a big American pulp and paper company. Operated for years in Newfoundland, lots of jobs, that's fine. 4 years ago, they pulled out on their own. Nobody kicked them out. And they left behind hundreds of jobs. And then they said to the then Newfoundland Premier, Danny Williams, well, we want access to the water rights. We want you to pay us for the water rights we left behind. And Danny Williams basically suggested where they might put that little idea. And so they turned to their good friend, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, and they said, we're going to launch a Chapter 11 challenge. This is where an American corporation can sue the Canadian government, and vice versa, but it doesn't happen vice versa. But they can sue the Canadian government if any level of government changes the rules and says, you've got to stop using so much water or whatever. They can sue for financial compensation. Instead of fighting for Newfoundland and saying, okay, let's go to an NAFTA panel and fight this out, the Harper government said, no, you don't need to do that, and paid them $130 million for the water rights that they left behind in Newfoundland. Now, why we're so upset about this is that this is a bad precedent that means that every pulp and paper, American pulp and paper, and if CETA is signed, every European company, energy, agribusiness, you name it, mining company operating in Canada needing water to do business will now be able to claim that they basically own that water as in perpetuity. So this is the way we are transferring, and so moved by Lois's statement, because this is the way we're transferring what has been seen as a public trust and a common asset step by step by step into the hands of private corporations, and then they're protected by these trade agreements, which is why I've been fighting trade agreements for 25 years, because I think they're dangerous, not against trade, not against trade agreements, but trade agreements that say we are going to impose a kind of discipline over governments that will totally and completely narrow the band in which and the operating field in which governments can operate and limit the ability of governments to govern on behalf of their people, the sovereign control of their resources, and so on. We are literally witnessing the creation of a system where our resources in this country, around the world, particularly in First Nations communities, being handed up to these transnational corporations. You might say to me, why would Stephen Harper initiate a deal like this? Because he believes in very, very small government. He, you know, if you go back and look at what he said about government when he was with the National Citizens Coalition, he basically hates government. He said he's on record many times saying he's against the Canada Health Act. He would privatize everything. Then you go back and see what his record said. Now he's being careful. He wouldn't dare come after the Canada Health Act, but you don't have to if you bring in an agreement like this that gives the big health insurance companies rights to come in and start competing. This is how you do it. You can say basically say, oh, free trade made me do it. Why is he doing this? Well, I think of Grover Norquist, who was the tax advisor to George Bush. He used to say that the proper size of government was small enough to put in a bathtub so that you could pull the plug whenever you needed it. That was his idea of what government should be. And when you have that ideology, then you're going to grab at everything and you're going to promote this. And you won't be surprised to know that the Harper government is now saying to municipalities who need to upgrade their water and wastewater systems, we will only give you money if you look to a public-private partnership. So you get the triple whammy of reduced funding of municipalities for this infrastructure upgrade, this condition of privatization if the federal government gives them money, and then, lo and behold, Suez and Veolia coming in here with their rights intact, signed in a CETA, the CETA agreement, and then you have what I call the perfect storm for water privatization, along, of course, with the markets. This is the concern, and this is what we're trying. I mean, I know I'm sounding like I'm coming from a number of places, but the common theme here that binds all of these concerns, and I could add another four or five, but I won't because that would be awful to do to you, but what binds all of these is a corporate grab, a private grab for water, because we're a world running out of water, and those who own water and those who control water are going to be both wealthy and powerful. Or as somebody said recently at a conference, an investment conference in London, England, he gave terrible statistics on the terrible crisis of the world's water and the poor, and he was, you know, almost crying about the crisis, and then he said, but there's an upside. And the upside is, for investors, there's buckets and buckets of money to be made from the water crisis. And I thought, well, at least you're honest, you know, at least you're telling it like it is. So we have a water movement here in Canada and around the world, a water justice movement. We call ourselves water warriors, and it is our deep determination not to let this continue and not to let this theft happen. Just immediately in the issues that I've talked about tonight, we need a fight back on CETA, and you need to know more about it. It really is going to be a very important fight in this country, and we have launched a national tour with Paul Moist of Canadian Union of Public Employees and the National Farmers Union, a number of other groups, and we're going across the country talking about the threat to CETA. There's a very fine film that we've just made, very short, 6 minutes, but it's really good for schools and your community groups and so on. We'll be uploading it on our website very soon, within the next week. So we're going to have lots of materials for people to work with, and we really do need to make this an issue. On fracking, we need a national moratorium, and Quebec has now sort of brought in a moratorium, although it's time sensitive, and you know, we're very worried the government won't stick with it. But they did have an environmental panel, and the environmental panel did advise for a moratorium on fracking. So we have a beachhead here in Canada to start to argue that we must be placing these moratoriums. And I know it's going to be difficult here in Alberta with the control of the energy industry, but we simply have to stand in solidarity with those who are being affected by this terrible gas fracking. We're even hearing reports now of small earthquakes taking place where there's been massive amounts of fracking in Pennsylvania and other places because they're like little explosions under the ground. And if you've got thousands of them going on, we're playing God. We have no idea what we're doing when we do this. We must not allow water markets. This just must become a prime issue in this province in every election. So what are my thoughts for how we get from here to a water-secure future? Really briefly, I'll just talk about some positive thoughts about what we need to do and then open this up for discussion. I think we need to build a water-secure future based on three fundamental principles. The first is that water has rights. Water itself has rights. Water was basically put by nature where it's needed. And we have got to stop moving it at our pleasure and convenience and profit from where it's needed for the functioning of a healthy ecological system and a healthy hydrologic system to where we want it. We've got to stop thinking this way. I mean, as we speak, they're building the world's biggest water theme park in Arizona. Arizona. It's going to have rivers that run so fast you can whitewater raft, and it's going to have waves so big you can surf on them. They don't have any water there. They're importing it. It's not sane. This is not the behavior of a sane species, I have to say. Water has rights to be protected and restored. We need to conserve it. We need to leave it where it has been put. We need to come down as hard as we can on polluters. I consider it one of the most grievous things, most grievous crimes, that someone would pollute water that others need for life. I think it's a grievous crime against Mike for what has happened to his water. Martin Luther King said, "Legislation may not change the heart, but it will restrain the heartless," which I think is wonderful. We need the rule of law. And a number of us are now working on the whole concept of the rights of nature. In fact, we just finished putting out a book called The Rights of Nature, The Case for a Universal Declaration on the Rights of Mother Earth. And we have presented it at the UN. We've presented it to the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. It is going to go to the Rio Plus 20 summit next year and be a challenge to those who want to commodify water, who want to commodify nature. This whole movement called PES, Payment for Environmental Services, where the only way the environment can be protected is if you put a price tag on it, and then you can prove that that price tag is worth more than the commercial use of nature. The UN actually has a whole unit working on how much nature is worth, because they can only think now in terms of everything must be commodified. They don't have another framework that thinks that maybe nature is not a commodity, it's the sacred gift of life. And that notion doesn't exist within the halls of power, I fear. So we need to establish the rights of nature, the rights of water, and fiercely protect water, which means that we're not talking about a free-for-all. We are talking about a well-managed commons. So that's my second, then, principle, and that is that water is a commons and a public trust. And I wanted to read to you, just before I came to that second part, I wanted to quote around this notion of the rights of nature a wonderful man named Cormac Cullinan. He's a human rights lawyer from South Africa who's written a wonderful book called Wild Law, an Earth Manifesto. And he says this: "The day will come when the failure of our laws to recognize the right of a river to flow, to prohibit acts that destabilize the Earth's climate, or to impose a duty to respect the intrinsic value and right to exist of all life will be as reprehensible as allowing people to be bought and sold. We will only flourish by changing these systems and claiming our identity as well as assuming our responsibilities as members of the Earth community." Isn't that absolutely gorgeous words? So that's the notion of respecting and honoring the water itself and the earth itself. And then there's the commons. The commons is a very old notion that we're trying to revive. And we think about the modern assault on the commons, the modern enclosure of the commons, as being this private grab. But there have been times in history when there have been other enclosures. The big one in Western history, society was the enclosure of the British Commons in Great Britain, when even though nobility owned the land, peasants were always allowed to fish and hunt and graze their animals because they would die if they didn't have this right. And those were removed in very draconian laws in the 1700s. And you may remember this nursery rhyme, but you might hear it with new ears when you hear this. It was the nursery rhyme that came out of that time. It said, "They hang the man and flog the woman that steal the goose from off the common, but let the greater villain loose that steals the commons from the goose." In other words, it's all right to basically destroy the life and livelihood of millions of people, but let those one of those people come back and try to assert their rights, and they will be severely dealt with. I think of SLAPs, you know, the environmental court injunctions against individuals who are trying to fight this system when I hear that. So the notion of the commons is to bring back this notion that some things are needed for all life and no one has the right to proprietary ownership of them. Water, the access to shorelines, fish, and so on, these must all be shared. Now, that doesn't mean, as I say, a free-for-all. We are talking about a well-managed commons. And the notion is then protected by something called the public trust doctrine, which basically says that by law, then, you have to protect the equitable rights of all to equitably share with this bounty and this resource. And therefore, for water, for instance, you do a 50, 60-year plan, and you say, how much do we have? What are the demands? Where are they going to be in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years? And how will we decide to equitably share this water? A great example that I find is Vermont, which didn't have any protection for its groundwater, and they had a whole bunch of companies coming in and just helping themselves, and it was a bad situation. 4 years ago, they brought in law. I worked with them, and it was really exciting to do this. Introduced, by the way, by a Republican state woman senator and a Democratic state woman senator. So it was really nice that they worked together on this. And they basically said their groundwater and their surface water is a public trust. And they say right in the legislation, it belongs to all Vermonters, it belongs to the future, and it belongs to the ecosystem. And they placed a priority use on it. So if everybody has the right to a certain amount for nothing, but then if you're a company and you're going to use a lot, you have to have a license, and they have a right to remove the license if you're abusing it. And the priority is drinking water and water for living for all, sustainable local food production over food production for export, and ecosystem protection. It's a very, very exciting model, and I think it's the model Alberta needs. It is so deeply the model Alberta needs. So that's the second concept. And the third is that water is a human right, and that nobody should be watching their child die of waterborne disease while others are hoarding and have all the access that they want. And in case you think that this is only happening in poor countries, you should know in Detroit, Michigan, they have turned the water off to, well, officially 45,000 residences, but people there say it's probably twice that, because they couldn't pay their water bills. And now Social Security is coming in and taking their kids away because they don't have water. And we're talking here in many cases of, you know, African American, poor, obviously people who don't have the money. So it's not far away. If you put this kind of commodification of water and it becomes out of reach to ordinary people, at the same time when you're creating a society that's dividing rich and poor, the class system that we're building, we're going to have an underclass in the so-called first world not able to buy water either. So this notion of a water as a human right is not just far away. Been fighting for years for this. We fought at the UN for this, and we could not get anywhere. Canada was the lead country opposing the right to water. The United States opposed it, England opposed it, and so on. This past spring, Pablo Solon, who is the ambassador from Bolivia to the UN, decided, you know what, our glaciers are melting, our children are dying, and I am not waiting any longer. So he put a resolution to the General Assembly for them to recognize the human right to water and sanitation. And everybody freaked. Oh, this is undemocratic. We need 20 years more study, blah, 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 blah. It was a riot to watch everybody protesting, right? And he wouldn't budge and he wouldn't water it down, pardon the pun. And on July 28th of 2010, and I was there at the General Assembly, it came to a vote. And I remember holding the hands of my two staff that were there with me and saying, no, we're not going to win this time, but it's so exciting it got this far and that we're here to watch it, and the language is wonderful and this is an historic moment. But I was softening them, you know, to prepare them for losing. Boom, they come to a vote, goes up in the big electronic board, 122 countries vote in favor. Not one voted against, even though they were. And 41 abstained. Canada, of course, being one of the countries that abstained, to our shame. It's just, oh, and then you'd love it. Then one after another, these countries got up and lectured Ambassador Solon, you know, about how he pushed the envelope and blah, 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 blah. And he was standing there kind of smiling. And I don't know what he was thinking, but I think he was thinking, what part of I just won do you not get? Like, you know, how come, you know, why, you know, you can lecture me all you want, 122 to nothing, I'm a happy guy, you know, today. So it was a lovely morning. 2 months later, the Human Rights Council also adopted the Human Right to Water and Sanitation, and this time spelled out the obligations of governments, and it is now a binding obligation. I've got a report just about to come out which explains the obligations of all governments, including ours, to put in a plan of action and to really promote this in their own countries and around the world. Now, that's where we come back to our friends fighting fracking, fighting the poisoning of their water, the many, many First Nations communities who don't have access to clean drinking water. I think we need to use these resolutions and this newfound right to fight back and fight back really hard. I'd like to see a constitutional challenge. I think this agreement will be what we make it to be, and that is, I don't know what that's going to be. And I think that the opportunity now is ours. We have won this fundamental right, and it is, you probably didn't read about it in the major newspapers either. We just keep fighting, and we just keep putting the material out, and eventually it gets through. But it really was a huge breakthrough. It's very seldom that a new set of rights is adopted at the United Nations General Assembly, and this was a very, very big one. And so it is. Next steps are going to matter a lot in terms of what we do. And I'll just, one quick last story and one last quote. This last story is that we have had a test case of the two right to water resolutions. One of them is from Botswana. It's from Botswana. And this is a story of the Kalahari Bushmen, who are an indigenous people who still live the way their ancestors lived, with loincloths and spears, and they hunt. They're hunter-gatherers. The president hates them. He calls them an embarrassing anachronism. He went to Oxford, my dears, and he wears Brioni suits and Italian shoes and beautiful, you know, jewelry and stuff, and he's terribly embarrassed. And so he's been removing them from the Kalahari Desert, the Kalahari Park, for years now, violently, and resettling them in settlements they don't want to live in. So when they kept coming back to the desert, they smashed their only water access, their water borehole, and they said they would kill anyone trying to repair it. And it's a terrible case. It's really a terrible human rights abuse. Well, they took, with Survival International helping them, they took their government to court, and in 2006 won the right to go back to the Kalahari. And then, meanwhile, we found out why the government really wanted them gone, and that's that they found diamonds in the Kalahari, and the De Beers and others want to use the water for diamond extraction. So, they didn't gain the right to their water. So, yes, you can go back to the desert, but no water for you. So they appealed, and 1 week before the July 28th resolution that was adopted by the Human Rights Council, General Assembly last July, they lost a second time. No, you do not have right to water. But they came back. Armed with the two resolutions, they came back and they fought it again. And this past January, the Supreme Court of Botswana came down with a ruling unanimously saying, yes, you do have the right to water. You have the right to have your bore well restored. You have the right to have a second bore well and more water access if you need it, and restitution from the government. It was an incredible first win as a test of this very important milestone. And I sometimes think every now and then that the human species takes an evolutionary step forward. And I feel somehow that this has been part of that. So I share that with you because I think we need to take that concept and bring it here to fight against the abuse and the theft of water in rural communities, in poor communities, in First Nations communities, and the corporate takeover of our water here in Alberta and around the country. Last quote, this is from Tolkien. I loved this quote before the movies, but I did love the movies. But this is Gandalf, and he's facing that army that terrible night when all living things may be killed. And, of course, a lot of it's around the death of nature. I kind of got Tolkien on the brain because a couple of years ago we had our AGM in Edmonton, and we took people on a tour of the tar sands, bus tour and helicopter and so on, and we came back and held a press conference, and I called it Canada's Mordor. And one of the energy people said a silly thing. He said it wasn't as bad as Mordor, and I think he should have denied the Mordor connection altogether, right? But anyway, and the Edmonton Journal had a big photo of the Mordor from the movie, and the Sin Crew, one of the Sin Crew sites, and it was just like, there you are, there's your case. Anyway, he's talking about stewardship, and I'm assuming I'm in a room full of stewards, and he says this: "The rule of no realm is mine, but all worthy things that are in peril as the world now stands, those are my care. And for my part, I shall not wholly fail in my task. If anything passes through this night that can still grow fair or bear fruit and flower again in the days to come. For I too am a steward. Did you not know?" Thank you so much.